slide this out. Feels like a podium. Makes me feel more comfortable than standing here, otherwise I don't know what to do with my hands. Anyway, first of all, Patrick, thank you for asking me to come down. We had a great trip down. No traffic. We got here like an hour and a half early, which rarely ever happens on long road trips. I've been coming to AA since 1987. I was 18 years old when I got here. Needless to say, I started drinking early. When I was around 12, I think I found my first drink. The first drink I ever had was the first spiritual experience I ever had. It was that important to me. As a kid, now mind you, this is all in hindsight, I was a mess. I don't know how much of a mess you can be when you're 12, but as much as you can be, I was. I would say probably the chief characteristic that governed the perception I had of the world around me and how I related to it was fear. I was afraid of my own shadow. I was afraid of everything. And the truth is, I have no idea why, because I wasn't raised in a house where my house was just like anybody else's. I'm from Boston. If you haven't picked up on the accent yet, you will. Both parents were married. There was no drinking in the house. My parents' parents drank. They were pretty bad drunks. So if there was anything, it was probably just the residual damage done to them by their own parents and their own drinking. But needless to say, alcohol was not tolerated in my house for exactly that reason. By the time my parents had gotten married and had kids of their own, they'd gotten out of their own alcoholic crazy homes, and they wanted nothing whatever to do with anything that looked remotely like that. Even the smell of it, my father would tell me, would set them off. In my house, you didn't drink. And unfortunately, the moment that I found alcohol, it fulfilled the one thing that I needed it to do, and I needed it to do that more than I needed anything else. I didn't need good grades. I didn't need to do what my parents told me to do. I didn't need to become something in the society in which we live. I needed to feel all right inside of my own skin. And I didn't know that when I was 12 years old, because I was just walking around with, you don't know what you don't know until you know it. And I didn't know that I wasn't comfortable inside of my own skin. I didn't know that I was consumed with wondering what other people were thinking about me and how they were perceiving me, and I was obsessed with trying to control that, trying to control how you were perceiving me. In order for me to be comfortable, I had to know that you were seeing me a certain kind of way. Basically, that way, in a nutshell, kind of evolved into the man. Whatever anybody else's idea of that is, and whatever mine was at the time. But I needed to be seen as the cat's ass. That was the only way that I was comfortable in relating to anybody else. When I found booze, it filled the bill. And at that point, I began to realize the best description of it I have is this. If you ever go to like an AA meeting in the summertime, right, you walk in, the central air conditioning is on. And it's running when you walk in the door, so you don't notice it. But as the speaker kicks up and starts to talk, you're straining to hear, but you're not aware of it until the air conditioning unit shuts off. And then all of a sudden you can hear more clearly. And you weren't aware the air conditioning unit was running until it shut off. And then suddenly the room becomes quiet. And it's only at that moment that you realize you're straining to hear. And there's a sense, there's just a slight sense of relief that comes from realizing that you're not straining anymore. And that's exactly what alcohol did for me, was I was straining to get through life, I was straining in my relationships, I was straining in school. But I wasn't aware of it because it was the only thing I had ever known up until I found the drink. And when I found the drink, it shut off. And then I suddenly realized that life sucked. I really hated it. I hated how I felt day in and day out. And when I was drinking, I didn't feel that way. And so immediately, my priorities got restructured. And again, I didn't realize that that's what I was doing, but that's exactly what I did. As soon as I found alcohol, all my priorities got restructured around the drink. Because I found that if I was going to do something, doing it drunk was better. If I was going to hang out with friends on the weekend, doing it drunk was better. If I was going to school, that was a lot better drunk. You have so much more fun in school when you were hammed than just going in and dealing with. I mean, school is just like, for somebody that's insecure, that's not like writing themselves. Like, I hear people talk about their high school career, like, you know, they were on varsity this or, you know, drama club, whatever. I was not that guy. If I could have stuffed myself in a locker and done my high school career from a locker, I would have done that. I just wanted to shrink inside of myself and run away. I was terrified, terrified. And unfortunately, when you're terrified, it's an easy target for bullies because they can pick up on that shit like sharks, like blood in the water. They can smell that crap like a mile away. And so I was an easy target, and I was picked on quite a bit, and I was not having a happy go of it until I found booze. And the booze seemed to be the great level. Because if I showed up at a party where I would normally not have been welcomed, if I had alcohol under my arm, if I had a case of beer, you're kidding? Come on in. Everything was fine. Once everybody started drinking and people started to relax and feel good, I could talk, I could socialize, I could forget about what you were thinking about me and just be. I could breathe. But unfortunately, you know, there's a price tag for everything. And here's kind of how it went. And this pattern with my drinking has never changed. My ability to cope with life circumstances, challenges, whatever, is really not all that hot because I'm empty and I'm consumed with fear. When I drink, I sober up the next day, and because I got hammered the day before, and physically, you know, my brain chemistry is all messed up, and physically I'm not feeling that well, and emotionally I'm a little more unstable than I was the day before. My ability to cope every time I drink keeps getting less and less. The problem is that every time I drink, I also get drunk. And I do stupid, crazy, retarded things when I'm drinking that have consequences. So my ability to cope is quickly going in the toilet. And the number of things that need coping with are going through the roof. And so what happens is that my life shifts permanently out of balance. And I say, I use the word permanently because that's the word that the big book uses to describe it. And that's exactly what happened to me. And by the time I was 14 or 15 years old, my life had shifted permanently out of balance. I was behind the eight ball, and I was never to recover that position again. Truth is, I've probably always been behind the eight ball. It's just that as I got older, more responsibility started to get mounted on, you know, into my life. As you progress forward through life, you're supposed to become an adult, and then you graduate to more responsibility, and there are certain life lessons you're supposed to be accumulating along the way so that when those more complex problems present themselves, you have a greater capacity to effectively deal with it. But since I crawled into a bottle when I was 12, I never pulled the life lessons out of any of those experiences. So physically, I was getting older, but emotionally, less. Not nearly quite so much. So by the time I got to be 18 years old, I had destroyed my high school career, destroyed my relationship with my family. But internally, because I mean, the outside damage, that stuff was horrible, but I got to tell you, I can adjust to anything. I really can. I'm a bit of a chameleon. And if I have good reason, namely the buzz, if I can get a good buzz and it's still working, then I'm going to adjust to whatever circumstances outside of me I have to in order to continue to indulge that. And that's just a fact. But here's what happened was that eventually my insides just stopped responding to the booze the way that they used to. It stopped setting me free, no matter how much I drank or what other drugs I threw in there with it, because I threw them all in, everything I could get my hands on, which as an adolescent wasn't all that much, but there's more of the story. I was lonely beyond description and isolated and cut off from everybody around me. And I lived in a torture chamber inside of my own head. And I would have given anything to establish any type of common bond with another human being. And I was just incapable of it. So by the time I got to be 18, I destroyed everything and I walked into an AA meeting. And the one thing I liked about AA was that people here seem to be pretty accepting of screwed up people. And I was screwed up. And I was a kid. And so when you're a kid walking into AA, people have a tendency to kind of make an extra effort to get you to stick around. And the reason that they do that is because they know the path you're going to be on if you don't. And there isn't one of us that rolls in here that wouldn't spare any of us that course if there was anything that we could do possible. But unfortunately, we find out that this is the kind of thing that we all have to learn and experience for ourselves. And all the talk in the world won't stop a young person in AA from going back out if that's what they feel like they have to do. And that was the case for me. I came here. I had fear concerning everything was the motivating factor in just about everything I did. And all of those actions and ideas that were based in fear were wrapped in a very solid cocoon of pride, which meant that change for me was completely impossible. It couldn't happen. Fear and pride cut me off from learning every lesson that was necessary out of my life experience in order for me to get along well with everybody else in the world in which I live. And so I did not touch alcohol or drugs for 12 years. I went to meetings. I made coffee. I had a sponsor. I did everything that I was supposed to do. I went through the steps a couple of times. Actually, I didn't go through the steps. I want to clarify that. I went to step meetings, and I read the 12 and 12. And I talked a lot about the steps, and I listened a lot about the steps. But the steps are a funny thing. They're like booze. I can talk about drinking from now until doomsday, but I'm not going to get drunk. I don't know anybody that goes to a bar and talks about alcohol. They don't. They go to a bar. They drink. That's how you get drunk. It requires action. And recovery is exactly the same thing. I never got drunk talking about booze, and I didn't get well talking about steps. They had to be done. And my first sponsor, who was a saint, because the guy listened to me drone on and on and on and on about a bunch of stuff that I would now consider to be irrelevant. If I had the spirit to do that, I would have killed me. I would have shot me in the head. I would have died. I would have shot me in the head and buried me behind the barn. But he listened to me. He listened to me for 12 freaking years. Actually, more like 8. And at about my 8th year, because I couldn't figure out what the hell this thing was all about. I couldn't figure out what, I didn't understand the third step. I didn't understand about turning your life to the world with the fear of God. My mind could not wrap itself around delineating the difference between my will and God's will. And I couldn't understand how, like, what was the point? What was the pearl? Like, where are we going with this is basically the question. I couldn't seem to isolate a direction and then seem to move in it. All I knew was that I was lonely and I needed to be in a relationship and I wasn't making enough money and I had to find out a way to conquer the universe inside of the next 2 years before I got too old. That was really it. You know, driven. Fear. And blindly stepping on the toes of everybody around me and completely oblivious to how my actions and my attitudes were hurting everybody around me, including my family. This happened. This continued to happen well into my sobriety. Booze is not the prerequisite for doing damage as a result of untreated alcoholism. It absolutely isn't. I did more damage sober with untreated alcoholism than I did ever when I was drinking. The one good thing about drinking is that it incapacitates me. I can't get off the couch. When I'm not drinking, I'm like I'm like a bundle of energy. I can like spread my damage everywhere. I can get out there and like really kill it, you know. And I did. Around my 8th year of doing what I think I was supposed to be doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you had asked me if I was doing AA, I would have told you yes. And that would have been backed up by most people. I mean, I was like the poster boy for young people in AA. By the time I was 25, I was sober 7 years. 26, I was sober 8 years. That was longer. I mean, if you know the demographic, the stats in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're sober longer than 5 years, you're sober longer than something like 60% of AA's population. Most of them are sober between 1 and 5 years on that constantly revolving door. And so I thought I had everything made. Relapse was unthinkable. But I got to tell you, I was coming to these meetings, man, and I'm listening to these people. They're getting up to a podium, and they're talking about this life second to none and how, you know, their life has been reconnected and come back together, and, you know, they've met this, you know, awesome person, and they're in a relationship now, and they just bought a house, and just got a promotion, and I'm like, you know, I've lost my fourth job inside of the same year. I was completely unemployable. Completely unemployable. I couldn't do anything consistent. On page 52 in the big book, it goes through, it has this breakdown of basically sober, untreated alcoholism, where it talks about we're prey to misery and depression. We couldn't seem to be of any real help to anybody else. I can't quote it verbatim. I should be able to. I've read it enough times, but it's like soup up here sometimes. But that was essentially me. I was an absolute mess, and I could not function. I couldn't function. I was still consumed with myself, my problems, and principally the number one problem was I was still self-reliant in their resolution, and that's the big deal. That's the big deal. Was we do the steps and we move towards God reliance, and I didn't understand how to get there. I didn't know what it was to be God reliant instead of self-reliant. I took a lot of pride in my ability to dissect problems, to pull them apart, to analyze them, to talk about them, and to try to understand them, and then to establish a course of action to try to correct them or rectify them. Every single one of them failed miserably because I was not empowered. And I didn't know how to become empowered, and I didn't even know that was the nature of the problem. And so around 8 years sober, these people were talking about this life second to none, and I'm not watching that happen in my own life. So the only conclusion I can draw after 8 years is that they're full of shit. They got to be lying. Or they know something I don't. That was another suspicion I had walking around AA after all these years. Everybody in there, like, there was some secret society inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody knew everything, and I was not part of it. And which was another thing that would have pissed me off if I thought it was actually true. But so I got sick and tired of listening to that old timer in the back with a feather in his cap, you know, repeating exactly the same bloody freaking thing every Monday night at exactly the same time. I got tired of all the retarded nicknames like Cadillac Joe and, you know, Angry Bob. That was so every meeting I went to, every new time, there was an angry someone. There was Angry Frank, Angry Bob. I wanted to get all the angry guys together. We could have an angry meeting. I got tired of all of it, and I became very, very critical and very, very frustrated. I became angry, Greg, and I didn't buy into any of this crap anymore. And so, in 8 years, I decided to stop going to meetings, and I didn't drink before. About a week after my 12th anniversary, I found my way into a bar, and I got to tell you, that was the best freaking drink I ever had in my life. I've been holding my breath on that one for 12 years. And I tore it up that summer. Wow! Absolutely did. By that point, there were all kinds of drugs out that weren't available when I was a kid. We had all the letter drugs, ecstasy, we had K, we had everything. And I did. I mean, I just was like smashing that shit in my face. I couldn't get enough of it. And I went for, I I killed it that summer. I had probably the best summer of my life. I had a blast. I absolutely did. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't. But, you know, there's a price for everything. And by the end of it, I started out in June having a blast, and by September I was homeless. And, and I picked up hepatitis along the way. And so the first, when you go to the doctor, right, you end up with hepatitis. Anybody, because hepatitis isn't uncommon in our social circles, it's pretty common. So when you get hepatitis, right, the first thing the doctor will tell you is, do not drink. You can't drink. And what I heard was, not negotiable. What I heard was, you know, like, don't get drunk all the time. And he really meant, like, no. Don't drink. Absolutely do not drink. And I absolutely did not do that. And so I continued to drink for the next 3 or 4 years. After the first probably 6 months of drinking, I was back in AA again, trying to get sober. Only I couldn't do it. Illness progresses, whether we drink or we don't. And I'm a living testament of that, because I can tell you that, I drank. I mean, whatever I was doing when I was in high school was exactly that. It was high school. It was crap. It's like drinking of a child. This was full blown, and all the time. And my liver was progressively getting worse. And it wasn't until about the fourth year that it really caught up with me. And my liver started to shut down. And I'm going to these meetings, and I'm trying to sober up. And I'm back in the big book, and I'm ferociously ripping through this book, trying to figure out why I can't sober up again. And I keep coming back around to these two areas, the spiritual experience and the maintenance of a spiritual condition. These two things just keep jumping out at me, but I can't understand how to have a spiritual experience. And I know it's in the steps, but I don't know what to do. I thought I'd done the steps. Going to those step meetings and reading it out of 12 and 12. So through a series of events, I'm not checking text, I'm checking time. Through a series of events, I ended up meeting my current sponsor. This is another guy that's going to be nominated for sainthood. I somehow managed to lie my way into a really good job. I was working at Boston University, and I was landscaping for them. But my liver had made going to work impossible. It's a physical job, and I couldn't. My weight was down by probably 40 pounds. I'm not a big guy anyway. When I lose weight, look at a stick figure. So I was a mess. There was a guy that I had known during the first 12 years that I was sober. I had seen him at meetings on a regular basis. You see guys who come in at the meeting and probably go to subs, but like, that's not a dude I want to get to know or talk to. Because he's either not too shady or there's something not right. The elevator's not going to the top floor. And that's what this guy was. I would see him come into the meetings, and he was always dressed well in a suit. He was a lawyer, I knew that. He drove a nice car, I knew that. But he wasn't like a corporate lawyer. He wasn't like a corporate lawyer. Like, he was like a mom lawyer. You know what I mean? Like, there was a drastic difference between what, it was just something coming off the guy, and I didn't like him. I run into this guy. I'm going into these meetings, and I'm gonna say this, and it's not meant to be critical of Alcoholics Anonymous, because what is said here and what I hear are oftentimes two different things. So I don't know what got lost in translation. I don't know how this ended up the way that it did. But I'm walking into these meetings, right, in Boston, and I'm raising my hand and I'm asking about this spiritual experience. And I remember one specific night, and I'm not up here to be critical of AA. I'm not, so please don't misinterpret it that way. But I walked into this meeting, and I'm dying, and I look like I'm dying. My liver is shutting down, and I'm gray, and I'm jaundiced, and I'm a stick figure, and I'm hunched over, and it's the middle of winter, and it's freezing, and there's no seats. And I walk in, and I sit down on the wet floor, because everybody's trapped all that snow and everything inside. And I'm sitting on the wet floor, and the meeting's going on, and I raise my hand, and the question I ask is what is the spiritual experience that the book is talking about, and how do I have it? How do I get one? Because I knew that the way that I had been doing Alcoholics Anonymous before was not going to work this time. I needed a game changer. Something had to be different. There had to be something that I was missing. And now my life was at stake because the doctor was begging me. He was pleading with me. He's showing me my test results. He's testing my liver enzymes. And they're in the thousands. It's supposed to be like 60 or 40. I'm like some astronomically high number. And so there were three people that raised their hand after that. And one mentioned something fleeting about God. The next guy mentioned something fleeting about God. But no specific answer to the question. And then after that, the guy raised his hand and started talking about his cat. Seriously, about his cat. And I knew at that moment that I was dead. I was a dead man. Because I instinctively felt that whoever wrote the book, and this was 75, 80 years ago, whoever wrote the book had discovered something magnificent, something incredibly powerful. But over the course of the years, it had been lost. And that's not unreasonable to think that a piece of information like that will get watered down over the years with a bunch of extraneous shit. And it wasn't available to me anymore. And I lost hope. But for a drunk, there's no place else where we can go. Nobody else wants us. Because they don't know what to do with us. Doesn't mean they don't want to help, they just don't know how. And they'll never know how. So I kept coming here. But I ran into this guy, David, the crazy mob boy. At a meeting randomly, probably maybe a week and a half or 2 weeks after that experience sitting in that meeting. And David recognized me and I recognized him, and he knew immediately that I was sick. But before he and I had a chance to have a conversation, I ran into him and he was at the podium. He was talking from the podium just like I am now. Minus the podium. I can't tell you what it was, but something about him was different, and I didn't know what. But that, in exactly the same fashion that something about him was off, that I didn't know what, from years ago. And I couldn't have pinpointed it, and even now I still can't entirely pinpoint what it was. But something about him had changed. The best way I can describe it was that his demeanor had softened somehow. He was at the podium and he was talking. David had raised his hand at the discussion meetings that I knew him at from years ago, and he always sounded like a retard when I heard him talk. But now, I should use that word. But now, right, he's standing at the podium, and he's talking this extraordinary message. He's talking about his experience and what's been happening so far. And he had this incredible story of what had happened since the last time I'd seen him, which was something like, 8 or 9 years ago. And he was talking about God dependency and service to others. He was talking about the guys that he was sponsoring, the things that he was discovering about God's world. He was talking about a life based on the practice of spiritual principles, and how he was changing, and as a result, his life was changing. He was talking about a spiritual awakening, and I was all ears. And for the first time in my life, I was teachable, because I was absolutely broken. The one thing that needed to happen in order for me to get well had happened, which is that I lost faith in my own ability to figure out the problem and to construct a solution and to execute it. I knew for the first time that I did not know. minus the booze, minus anything else, I had no idea what the hell was going on planet Earth and how to live. I was broken. I was busted. And I was desperate because I was dying. And so David and I got together and we started talking. And he would come over and had this little basement apartment that I was working in, which actually probably would have been really nice if I'd been able to put the furniture in it, but I couldn't. I had this job that I was hanging on to by a thread. And he would come over and we would talk about steps. And we would talk about, you know, his life experience. And we just kind of got caught up. And this probably happened for like 3 weeks in a row. He would get put on his jacket and he would leave. And I would put on my jacket and I would go to the bar. And I would drink. And then the following day, I wouldn't be able to move. Or the day after that, or the day after that. If I could move, I went to the liquor store or to the bar. That was the only thing I know how to do. So this one day, it was a Friday afternoon, and David shows up. But I'm getting hope. It's starting to filter into my head. I'm beginning a new solution and a new course of action is beginning to outline itself here. So I'm very much interested in what David's doing. And David's talking to all these people he knows and his sponsor. And as it turns out, I knew his sponsor from years ago. But I only knew of him. I didn't know him. But the guy lived in Baltimore now, and that's why I'm down here. So it was a Friday afternoon, and David's car pulled up in front of my apartment as I was walking home from work. More like sludging home is more like it. He pulled up, and he said, "Here, I want you to talk to Steve." Steve was his sponsor. So he handed me the phone. And Steve said to me, he said, "Greg," he said, "listen, would you be interested in coming down to spend the weekend with me so we can, you know, do some steps?" So he'll talk about that step work. So I said, "Yeah, I was definitely interested in getting together." I said, "But Steve, I don't have any money." He said, I couldn't afford to pay for a ticket or for anything to travel down there. And I didn't know how he was in Baltimore. How the hell am I going to get there? I couldn't buy a plane ticket or anything. And he said, "Greg, I didn't ask if you had any money." I said, if you have the time, are you willing to spend the time to come down here and hang out?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely." That was like the best offer. Nobody was asking me to come hang out with me at that point. That was like the best offer I heard in a long time, so I was all about it. I said, "Yeah, I would love to come down." And so I did. But I did via David. Steve got in his car and drove. We each drove 8 hours one way. David and I and two other guys got into his car and drove. I don't know if any of you have been to Boston, but on a Friday night, on a Friday afternoon, you're not going anywhere. All right. So Boston traffic is atrocious, and at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, David threw me in his car and we drove down to Jersey. Steve drove up from Baltimore to Jersey and passed me off. I spent the weekend with him driving around, and then on Sunday they did it again to get me back home to go back to work on Monday. Over the weekend in that car, I went through steps 1 through 7 with Steve, and he gave me instructions on 8 to write my list and then to call. And I got scared, and I didn't write the list, and I started drinking again. So I called Steve because I was afraid he would fire me. I was afraid he wouldn't work with me. And I called him, and I said, "Look," I said, "I'm drinking." I said, "And I can't stop right now." I said, "But I know I'm going to have to, or I'm going to die, one or the other. So when I'm ready to stop, will you still help me?" He said, "Greg," he said, "it doesn't work like that." He says, "We don't fire people." He said, "This is what I'm going to do." He says, "I'm going to buy you a plane ticket. It's open-ended. This is my sponsor. I don't know what anybody else experiences, but this is what was done for me. May not be the run-of-the-mill, but it saved my ass." And he bought me an open-ended plane ticket and left it at Providence, Rhode Island. He said, "All you have to do is show up at the airport with a driver's license. He said, if you can get on the plane, I'll pick you up at the airport, and we'll pick up where we left off." And I said, "Okay." So I continued to drink for probably another 2 months, and I was absolutely on death's freaking door. I called him, and I got on that plane, and I came to Baltimore. And we picked up where we left off. A whole bunch of stuff has happened since then. And that was in 2003 when that happened. And my life has not been the same since. However, that's not the end of the story. So what Steve started to show me, he began to take me into his life and to show me how he practiced these principles, which is what I really think the role of a sponsor is. I mean, I've been spoiled rotten with sponsorship, obviously. But Steve spent a lot of time, both him and his sponsor, spent a lot of time talking with me and showing me. In other words, and we didn't do like zip code AA. We did like interstate AA. We went everywhere. We were always in the car, traveling somewhere, always in the car, talking about AA, always in the car, listening to speaking tapes and CDs. I mean, it was, for every prayer that I ever said in desperation, wanting to understand or learn how to practice a spiritual way of life, those prayers were answered when my sponsor showed up in my life. Because that's all this guy does. It's his life. Practice the spiritual principles, God dependency, and service to others. That's what he does. And since the day I've known him, he's always been there for me to continue helping me along my own path. And I've made him suffer for it. A royal pain in the ass. There was a meeting that he and I were at shortly after I arrived back in town. And mind you, I'm dying of liver failure. All right, and the fear hasn't stopped. I'm still consumed with myself. So I'm terrified about dying, about not being able to get a job, about where I'm going to live, about all this stuff that's on my head, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and my mind just moving at 3 million miles an hour. But I go to this meeting on a Tuesday night in New York, Pennsylvania, and my sponsor, his back is to me, and he's talking to a couple of guys that are facing me, and I'm standing behind him kind of kicking rocks. You know, when you go to a meeting and you're still sick and you don't know anybody there, right, you got two fears. One is that somebody's going to walk up and talk to you. The other fear is that nobody's going to walk up and talk to you. And so I'm kind of doing this deal. You know, I'm back then. I'm just kind of getting lost. I don't know anybody. My hands are in my pocket, and I'm like, you know, staring at the ground, and I don't know what to do with myself. And Steve turns around. He sees me standing there, and he's like, you know, we had already recapped where we had been, and he was like, great, you could find a newcomer to work with. You got to be kidding me. Like, what? Like, I'm like a month sober. I feel like crap. I've got nothing. And I feel like I haven't got anything to offer anybody. And he's like, Greg, the newcomer's the ticket to freedom. You've got to find somebody to work with. They're inside. And he embarrassed me in front of the guys that were staring at me, and I got really pissed off. And he must have seen the look in my face because he stopped. And he put his arm on my shoulder and he walked me into the meeting. And he found the most screwed up looking guy because the way I looked, I mean, I was like hunched over, my stomach was, my liver was distended, I was like three shades of gray. My liver had not repaired. I still had, you know, my enzymes were still in the tens of thousands, and I was a mess. And so nobody in that meeting with half a brain in their head was going to give me the time of day in terms of, like, you know, me trying to help. And Steve knew this, so he found the most screwed up guy in the meeting. So there's this guy over in the corner, right, that's sitting in a chair, he's got his legs extended in front of him, and he's got his arms crossed and his head down, he's got a line of drool going from his mouth to his shirt. And he goes, go ask that guy if he wants a cup of coffee. And I looked at him like he had nine heads. I was like, you got to be out of your mind. I'm not talking about losing. The matter is, I was just terrified. I didn't know what the hell I was going to say to the guy. But I agreed to do it. I went over and I kicked him in the shoe and the head came off. And, you know, he was just drunk. He was drunk. He was hammered. And I asked him if he wanted a cup of coffee. He said, yeah. So I went and I got him a cup of coffee. I got myself one and I sat down next to him. And for that 1 hour, 1 hour out of the day, I was not thinking about me and my problems. I was thinking about what I was going to say to this guy at the end of the meeting to try to help him. 1 hour. And then the meeting ended. The guy got up, ran out the door, probably because he knew what I wanted. He was about to get jumped. And he bolted. And then the next night that I went to a meeting with my sponsor, Steve did exactly the same thing again. He found the most screwed up guy in the room. He said, go ask that guy if he wants a cup of coffee. For 1 hour out of the day, I was not thinking about me and my problems. And that's how it started. And then probably the most significant event probably even my life up to date, took place about maybe 3 weeks or a month later. Tommy from Jersey. 2003, Tommy from Jersey was 20 years old, just a little punk. And he always had his cap screwed just a little bit to the right, just driving nuts. And but I didn't know Tommy. I'd seen him in the meetings, right? And but we'd never met. And I'm walking up Market Street. It was August in York. I don't know if you've been to York, Pennsylvania, in August, but it's like 93 degrees with 67% humidity. And when your liver stops working, you excrete every toxin in your body out of your sweat glands. So you stink bad. And I stunk. I was tired. I was exhausted. I was looking for a job that I couldn't even hold anyway. I don't even know why the hell I was looking for work. But I was miserable, and I was pissed off, and I had daggers for the entire universe. And Tommy is walking down the street. He looks up, sees me, and he crosses. And my freaking blood boiled. Absolutely boiled, because I knew what was going to happen. Tommy's going to walk up. You know, like when, you know, you kind of meet somebody in AA, and, you know, you have, like, you have those kinds of conversations that are, like, all, like, slogans, you know, like, sloganese. That's what I kind of call them. You know, dude walked up, and he's like, you know, saying, hey, I was like, oh, I'm just taking it a day at a time.
Hell no.
Hell no. Not in the afternoon. With my failing liver, a mountain of problems, and really bad sweat glands. I wasn't having it. And I just really, I did not want to talk to anybody. And Tommy walks up to me, and he says, he introduced himself, and he asked me what I'm doing. And I told him I wasn't doing anything. And he says, Greg, look, he says, I was shooting dope yesterday. And I just got my paycheck. It was a Friday. He says, I don't want to shoot dope tonight. Do you think maybe I can hang out with you so I don't get high? And I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened, but all I know is that in less than a millisecond, I went from wanting to stick a fork in this kid's face to completely abandoning every idea or concept I had for myself. This kid became the center of my universe, and the only thing I wanted to do was help him. I didn't want anything from him. It was an immediate shift, an awakening of probably the most powerful kind, I've ever experienced in my life. And it started from not thinking about me 1 hour a day, just trying to think about somebody else. But the point is that the concept got in my head. In other words, Steve was very clear on the idea that I was not empowered to fix my problems, that I needed to have a God of my own understanding, and the only way to get to God was to serve Him, and the only way to serve God was to serve others. So that's why he had me doing that, just for 1 hour a day. And so Tommy and I went back to the place I was staying in, and I didn't know what to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I screwed this thing up royally, but I knew what not to do. I had 16 years of what not to do in Alcoholics Anonymous at that point, and I told Tommy everything. And we talked about 5 hours, and at the end of that conversation, he asked me to sponsor him. And I did. 3 weeks later, Tommy relapsed again, and he left, and I've never seen him again. I have no idea what's happened. But what happened to me was I got a taste of something, and I went after it. And I started working with every guy I could get my hands on and tapping them at the door. I also became very arrogant and opinionated, and I started to believe once again that I knew something, and I was more than happy to tell you all what I knew. And tell you how you didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. And I still had hang-ups with regard to money and relationships, or power and sex, or essential things. And those areas in my life and in my being were constantly fighting for ground in my relationship with God. And because I met with some success with a couple of guys that sobered up, and I started a meeting up where I was living that got very popular. They had about 300 people every Monday night. I started to think I knew something again, and I started to think that this thing was about me. And
you can all know where it's going. In 2009, I relapsed again. I've been back now. I live at the Mission in Baltimore, the Helping Up Mission. I've been there now for about 8 months. Something happened again, another awakening, as profound as that one with Tommy. Specs of which I probably don't have the time to get into. But when I look back over my experience and I ask myself, you know, what happened, because people kept asking me, you know, because I was sponsoring like a lot of guys and I was doing just what I'm doing now. I was traveling out of state to speak at meetings, and I had a very full, very well-developed life in AA. But there were things in my own being that were competing in my relationship with God. Two most powerful instinctual drives we have, sex, which is the second most powerful. First one is for survival, which means if you're not wrestling alligators or jumping out of a burning building, you're thinking about getting laid. Am I right? That's how it was for me. I don't know what it is for you. So there was that, and then you see, all my life I've been on the outskirts of life, on the outskirts of the world. I couldn't hold a job with a title that gave me a sense of pride or an identity. I didn't have like lawyer, that meant that I wore lawyer clothes and I carried a briefcase and I acted like a lawyer. I didn't have that. I didn't know what I was or where I fit in. And when I sobered up and I started doing all this work, I wanted a place in the world in which I live, and I wanted it to be respectful, and I wanted, and I didn't want to be alone anymore. And it wasn't like a mild want, it was a major want. And when I walked into this thing doing, you know, working, trying to help others as a service to God, I expected that God was going to bring that stuff into my life. And 5 years later, when that shit hadn't materialized, I was pissed. It's not how it works. God doesn't compete, and he doesn't bargain. He doesn't have to. Because what he's offering is the best it's ever going to be. It's the best it can be. By my nature and the laws that govern my nature, I am meant to be connected with him. And when I'm not connected with him, I feel that separation and fear. That's how it communicates to me. That's how I know I'm off. That's when I'm off. And so anything that stands between me and my Creator has to go. Not because God wants to make me miserable, because he wants to bring me back into alignment with what's in my best interest, with what will not harm me. And so that's why it can't be negotiable. So all that stuff that I felt that I wanted and couldn't, even the obsession for alcohol just became an obsession for the relationship and an obsession for a place in society. And the reason that drive was so powerful, was so strong, was that it was a compensation for all the insecurity and all the fear that I felt about not being able to fit in, about not feeling like I was enough. I'd always been ashamed of who I was throughout all of my life, never feeling like I measured up to anybody else, either in AA or out of it. And I felt that if I could acquire that stuff, I'd be just like everybody else. I'd be normal. And without it, I just felt like this stupid, insignificant loser, no matter how much I did to help anybody else. But without money, without a title, nice car, without something in the material world to show for my actions, I felt lost. And so that stuff became more important than my relationship with God. And when I couldn't get it, I flushed everything. And I've spent the last 5 years out there working it out. which means that I've basically been sitting in a chair and drinking for 5 years and thinking, with intermittent spurts back into AA to try to recollect whatever it was I had in the past. The funny thing about relapse is that whatever the forces are that drive you out, if you don't resolve those, you're not coming back. That's how it was for me the first time I relapsed. This thing had to deepen for me in order to come back. And this last time was no different. So so needless to say, the last 8 months have been full of awakenings and growth, and the friendships that I started years ago, like Joel, who came down with me, the new ones I've met, the old relationships, they just required a little bit of water, just some time and attention. It just came right back again. So the last 8 months I've been kind of reunited with my sponsor and my group, with a bunch of guys that that really genuinely care about what happens to me. And spiritually I've gotten centered again. God's up front, number one, no conditions applied. For the first time in my life, I am perfectly content with single. Love it. Wouldn't change it. But open to anything. In other words, there's no more conditions applied to my relationship with God. It just can't be. I can't afford it. So, I'm in college for the first time in my life, all kinds of weird things have happened, like in the way of in terms of my character. Like, I'm capable of doing things now I was never capable of doing before. College was one of them. My relationships with people are so much better. I'm at peace. I'm not angry anymore. I'm not pining for this or longing for that. I've just become very content. The screwed up thing about it is that I have nothing right now. Nothing. I live in a dorm with 70 other guys. I have a locker. Everything I own is stuffed into this locker and Joel's closet. I've got my schedule. I get up and I'm up at 4:30 in the morning. I go to school. I'm there anywhere from 12 to 14 hours a day. I'm exhausted by Wednesday. My schedule's demanding. I have my meetings. I have guys that I'm working with again. Guys that are working with me again. I've got a sponsor on a regular basis. I get an opportunity to come down and do something like this. It's a good life, but it's a good life not because I have all this stuff. It's a good life because I'm content without it. It's taken me a long freaking time to get to it. And the strangest thing is that when you become content without it, that's when you can have it. Weirdest thing. Everything in AA is all asked backwards. It's all paradoxical. But I might be going over, and I don't want to do that. Nope. Pretty much right on the money. Anyway, guys, thanks very much for having me down. I really appreciate it.